The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
Now, one third of people can be classed as poor singers, with only 1.5% suffering from what's called congenital amusia, better known as tone deafness. But what exactly is the science behind not having a note in your head? Well, we're joined by Dr. Peter Q. Fordrescher, who's Professor of Psychology and Director of Auditory Perception and Action Lab at the University of Buffalo. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat, and thank you very much.
Now, how many people generally in any population can, as they say, hold a tune?
Well, it depends a little bit on how you measure things. The way we measure things in our lab is we look at the proportion of time you can match a pitch within what we call a musical semitone. So this is the difference between one pitch on a piano keyboard and an adjacent pitch on the piano keyboard. And if you measure it that way, it's approximately about a third of the population who are not able to do this consistently. And if you look at the proportion of people who are able to do this kind of behavior consistently, if you define that as being, let's say, someone who can do it 90% of the time, it's actually quite a few people in the population. It's probably about 40% of the population who are able to perform with that kind of consistency.
Yeah. Now we often hear when you look at talent shows and they complain about an artist maybe being a bit pitchy at times.
Yes.
In other words, they're not hitting the note in precisely. They're slightly off the frequency.
Yes, I see.
A little bit. Now, how typical is that? I mean, how do you define a good singer? Is a good singer someone who's pitch perfect 100% of the time, or, you know, someone who gets through a tune and by and large, you know, it's satisfactory to most of the listeners?
Yeah, so I would tend to be more on the by and large satisfactory to most of the listener side, but of course I'm doing this from the perspective of a psychologist who's interested in people who exhibit a kind of mismatching behavior. Now, when you're talking about someone who's a little bit pitchy, who doesn't sound quite right, there you're moving to a level of kind of pickiness and technicality, which gets to be quite a lot greater. And so you are bringing in many more people in the population who could be falling under that pitchy category. However, I would like to point out that in talent shows, when people are measuring this quality of pitchiness, sounding bad, etc., there's a lot more that goes into those judgments other than pitch accuracy. And it's worth mentioning that there are a fair number of singers we would think of as not so accurate, not so good, who actually sing with very good pitch. And by contrast, there are some fairly famous singers who are not necessarily always singing with accurate pitch. Now, I won't name names on the latter, and so that I don't have a nice lawsuit coming around to me. But on the former, I think I can mention one rather well-known name, which is on the TV show American Idol, which you might have seen bits of in Ireland. Several years ago, there was a contestant named William Hung, who only made one round in the show. He sang Ricky Martin's She Bangs, if you remember that tune from back in the 90s, was deemed a very poor singer. And then a little while ago, I analyzed how William sang the song, compared it to Ricky Martin's original tune, and to my surprise, noticed that William was singing the song with perfect pitch, and actually even without any musical background. He was singing a cappella, and he sang every note perfectly, and he sang every note very cleanly, but it was other factors that got him basically laughed off the show. So I think it's important to bear that in consideration, too.
You know the way you can hear a bum note? Someone hits a bum note in a piece, and you say, ouch. And sometimes you don't even know the piece, but you know that that note does not fit for some reason. So us humans, we have some innate sense of the order of things.
Yes, we do. And a lot of that has to do with our innate sense of, it's not quite innate because it involves learning, but it involves very early learning, our sense of tonality. Right, so tonality is something we learn about when you learn a musical instrument, you learn a music theory, but you don't have to take those classes to know what tonality is, because through exposure to music, we get a sense for what notes belong together when you start to hear music that is in a certain key. And if someone sings a note that does not fit within the key, for most listeners, that really pops out as being out of place. Now, if you pull it off well, You can make it sound good, right? So there's a, you know, that sort of thing you learn when you learn to do improvisation. So if you play a bum note, play it with confidence, and then it sounds like something interesting. However, you mentioned congenital amusia before. So one of the hallmarks of congenital amusia is those individuals cannot tell when one of those bum notes is occurring in a piece.
Now, that's people who are literally tone deaf.
If
you try to sing a song out of tune, and a friend of mine is brilliant. He can sing Edelweiss from The Sound of Music in a way that is excruciatingly awful. He knows it is, and he does it to entertain us all. I've tried to imitate him, and I can't. I cannot sing as out of tune as he is able to do.
Yeah, it's actually tremendously hard. I mean, there's a comic song that I heard several years ago called "I'm Tone Deaf," which one of my colleagues played at a conference, and the presenter remarked that it's actually an incredibly hard song to sing because we become very hardwired to sing in the correct way. So this is one of the ironies of this area of research, that it's actually hard to pretend to be a poor pitch singer. So I think it's kind of good for me as a researcher, because it means it's fairly hard for my participants to malinger and actually pretend like they're poor pitch singers.
Yeah. Now jazz tends to wander along unpredictable musical routes. And also you get what I would call a blue note in a song, which, you know, I thrill when I hear a perfectly executed blue note. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that blue note should be in theory wrong.
Yes, it is. And so this is where we get into the interesting tensions within music. So all music is built around a kind of dynamic pattern of tension and relaxation. And so the notes that we would call tonally, quote unquote, correct in a piece of music are those that would sound correct and provide for the listener generally points of relaxation. Now, if you build music only around points of relaxation, you effectively have most child songs. You know, they're nice to listen to, but they don't give us a lot to work with, you know, in terms of what most listeners want to have. Most listeners want to have little bits of dissonance and little bits of tension. And so a well-placed blue note can do that. And as I mentioned, a lot of it has to do with the context in which it is. A lot of it has to do with your knowledge before music. So every time you listen to music, you're using expectations that you have built in through years of listening to lots of music, as well as expectations that are part of the specific piece. And so as you are listening to the jazz pieces you're mentioning, then a lot of that is coming, a lot of your enjoyment is coming from the fact that you know you are about to hear a note which should be wrong, but is not wrong. Yeah. And that's a delightful point of tension for most listeners.
And it's like enjoying variations on a theme in classical music. You know the theme, and then you enjoy the difference. Finally, I should ask you, Peter, can you teach a bad singer to sing well?
You can, although it probably depends on the particular type of bad singer you're working with. And sorry to be a bit waffly there, but I think that is the way it is. So for instance, we've done some studies using visual feedback. So there's a very nice free app. I'm not in the pay of this company, so I think I can mention it with a clear conscience. It's Errol Singer Studio. You can get it on your phone, and it shows you a readout of the pitch you're singing along a kind of piano scroll notation superimposed on a linear depiction of the note you're singing. And so you can see when you're singing a little too high, see when you're singing a little too low. And we found that even after 20 minutes of singing with this, most participants got significantly better. Now, the caveat there is that if the small portion of the population has true poor pitch singing, may not be able to benefit from that. There are a few studies on congenital amusics, and they're very mixed results. There's a very nice case study. A fellow from Canada named Tim Falconer wrote a book called Bad Singer about his journey trying to deal with his own congenital amusia. And he, for over the course of a year, tried to learn to sing better. And at the end of the year, he was actually no better, I'm afraid, than at the beginning of the year. But he learned a lot about himself. So it sort of depends on what's going on with you, I'm afraid. But most people, I think, who have trouble singing can in fact sing better and should sing better. I think we should all sing more in general, whether we're accurate or not, just for other reasons.
And so say all of us. Dr. Peter Q. Fortrescher, the Professor of Psychology and Director of Auditory Perception and Action Lab at the University of Buffalo. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.